the Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Good morning and welcome to the third day of our March Term of Court held here at the School of Law. Justice Cohen Camp is recovering from surgery, so he will not be physically present this morning. However, he is listening to the oral arguments over the internet and will fully participate with the court in the consideration of the cases this morning, as well as the other cases during the term. The first case for oral argument this morning is Highmark Federal Credit Union Appellant versus Wells Fargo Financial in South Dakota, Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Rodney Leffholz, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Wells Fargo, we have Mr. David Piper, an attorney from Dickinson, North Dakota, who is a member of the State Bar of South Dakota. With that, Mr. Leffholz, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. Yeah, please, the court, counsel. Do I understand correctly that my 10-minute rebuttal is already reserved, or do I have to...
Yes, it's already reserved.
My name is Rod Leffholz, and I represent Highmark Federal Credit Union of Rapid City, formerly known as the Rapid City Federal Teachers Credit Union. The case here involves the mortgage foreclosure of a home, and the issue is one of lien priority. There's really two ways to decide the lien priority question. The first is, as it's normally decided, first in time is first in line. The trial judge decided the lien priority question using equitable subrogation, and it's my argument to you here today that I don't feel equitable subrogation was the proper way to decide this case, and I'm asking this court to rule that the lien priority issue should be decided as it almost always is, that being first in time is first in line, to take whatever proceeds are available from a mortgage foreclosure. The facts of the case are quite simple, and I'm sure you have all been involved in these in one form or another before. About 10 years ago, a couple purchased a home in the Belle Fourche area, and they borrowed about $120,000 from what I will call the first lender. And they granted a first mortgage on their home to that first lender for somewhere in the neighborhood of $120,000. A few years later, obtained what is commonly known as a home improvement loan from my client for $24,000, which at that time would be called a second mortgage, second to the first lender that lent the $120,000. And then subsequent to that, a third lender came along, and that, in this case, it's Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo lent monies enough to pay off the first mortgage and the second mortgage, which is my client's mortgage, and lent even some more monies to these homeowners.
And your mortgage was a collateral real estate mortgage.
We're cutting right to the chase, Your Honor. Yes, it's a unique mortgage. It's a collateral real estate mortgage. It's commonly called a homeowner's mortgage, but the history of it is that it's very similar to a UCC filing on personal property. And it's kind of unique to agricultural states, I think. I'm not sure of that. But as you're all aware of, being in an agricultural state, it's very common for a farmer rancher to grant a security interest in their personal property, and a UCC filing is then made, which lasts for 5 years and is a blanket filing of whatever personal property the farmer rancher cares to put up as collateral. Could be crops, livestock, machinery, whatever. And then the farmer is allowed to borrow money in the spring, and the principal goes up, and in the fall when they pay off some of the principal, it goes down. Well, as you know, a first mortgage can never go up. A first mortgage, a conventional mortgage, I should say, can never go up. It can only go down. And once you pay off some of the principal, that principal can never come back again. But as you indicate, this is a collateral real estate mortgage, and so it's similar to this personal property mortgage with a UCC filing, only now the collateral is not personal property, it's real estate. And the farmer rancher can pledge real estate to obtain a loan and pledge as security in real estate and borrow against that, have the principal go up, pay off some of the principal, have it go down again. And the law is very specific. The collateral real estate mortgage can never be satisfied until the balance is zero and a satisfaction is asked for. If that's not the case, the collateral real estate mortgage always stays in full force and effect, save one thing. Like a UCC filing, after 5 years, it does evaporate unless it's re-upped or reaffirmed, I guess, by the lender. And that's not an issue in this case. But except for that, a collateral real estate mortgage always stays in force in effect, even though the principal goes to zero, unless there's a satisfaction of that mortgage. In this case, there's never been a satisfaction of that mortgage. Even to this very day, there's not a satisfaction of that mortgage. And Wells Fargo never asked for a satisfaction. The monies that they lent went to pay off what I've termed the first lender, or the first mortgage holder, and they paid down to zero my client's home equity loan, or as you've indicated, a collateral real estate mortgage. But they didn't ask for a satisfaction, and this is not unusual. There could be reasons why that happens, because of interest rates or because the homeowner wants to again borrow against the equity of their home to make more home improvements or whatever. The same would be the case in an ag situation. Even though the principal goes down to zero in the fall when the cattle are sold, that doesn't mean the mortgage evaporates. It can be borrowed against again in the spring when it's time to put in the spring planting. That's the same with a home equity loan. So the young couple, of course, like a lot of people today, fell on hard times and they didn't make their various mortgage payments. And so I began on behalf of Highmark Federal Credit Union a mortgage foreclosure. And it was objected to in terms of my lien priority by Wells Fargo, who I argued at that time was in second place to my now first place collateral real estate mortgage. The trial judge granted the equitable subrogation argument and said first in time is not first in line. And Wells Fargo was allowed to leapfrog ahead of my collateral real estate mortgage, which I argue is not fair. And some cases talk about whether or not fairness is involved here. Well, clearly I was behind a $120,000 mortgage prior to this happening. After this happened, I'm now behind about a $180,000 mortgage. So I have no chance of recovering on this home, which is not nearly worth that much. But more importantly, I have not found a case involving equitable subrogation and collateral real estate mortgages or home equity loans. Some states use a different term than we do in South Dakota. There's no case that rules the way Wells Fargo is asking you to rule. If you rule in favor of Wells Fargo, this will be the first reported decision that rules that you can leapfrog a collateral real estate mortgage without asking for and receiving a satisfaction of that mortgage.
Is there a disputed fact about whether that there was a request by Wells Fargo to satisfy the mortgage?
Oh, I don't think there was. And in fact, we're not even sure what their intentions were. I at the very least, Wells Fargo made a mistake. At the most, the borrower never wanted it satisfied and would not have asked. Wells Fargo really can't ask my client for satisfaction. They have to demand that the borrower ask my client for satisfaction. And of course, if he doesn't ask for it, they won't lend him the money. So, I mean, he will ask for it if the latest borrower asks my client for that satisfaction. But they didn't ask for it. And we don't know that perhaps the borrower didn't want that satisfied. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. He obviously didn't at the time that it was paid down to zero, because the problem came about here when he reborrowed that $24,000 from my client after it had been paid down to zero by Wells Fargo. He took that that credit back again. And
did that happen almost immediately after?
I think the short answer is yes. I would say within a month or two it happened, but that's probably pretty immediately. So the borrower, obviously, I guess would be the answer to your question, is obviously the borrower wanted that money back again because he borrowed it from our client. We were none the wiser. We knew that the loan had been paid down. I'm not trying to mislead you. We would have been paid down, but collateral real estate mortgages are paid down all the time. And the teller at the window, when the person comes in for a draw on their home equity loan, unless it's shown on their screen that they that the borrower doesn't have this credit anymore, they grant new monies to that borrower. And because there was no request by Wells Fargo or the borrower to satisfy that collateral real estate mortgage, my client lent the $24,000 back out again.
You know, there's various iterations of the doctrine of equitable subrogation, and I don't want to pin you down onto a particular iteration, but is there room in South Dakota for the doctrine to exist in some form? And I when I ask the question, I'm not implying that it should necessarily apply to your case. I'm asking a big global picture. From your perspective, is there room for our statutory priority scheme and the doctrine of equitable subrogation in some form?
Under certain circumstances, I think there are. Specifically, not to avoid your question, but just for a moment, in collateral real estate mortgages, unless you ask for satisfaction when the balance is zero, you don't get it. No satisfaction was asked for, therefore they didn't get it. But in the situation like a mechanic's lien, where a carpenter goes out and tacks $10,000 worth of shingles on your roof, they have a mechanic's lien for 120 days, and then they file it, and it's good forever. And that mechanic's lien is superior, or is inferior, rather, to the home mortgage. Now, if someone comes along and pays off that home mortgage, if the facts are such that that carpenter that tacked those shingles on is no worse off than he or she would have been before, then I think they should be inferior to what you might call a third lender. Not the first lender, not the mechanic, not the carpenter, but the third lender. They probably should be inferior to that third lender because they're no worse off than they were before when they tacked that $10,000 worth of shingles on the roof, inferior to the $100,000 or $200,000 home loan that was there before. Now, if there's, it's more complex than that, I think, according to the case law that I've read. If the lender is just negligent and just doesn't do the things to put themselves in a first position and they're negligent in doing that, then maybe even the mechanic's lien shouldn't allow for equitable subrogation. But I think in some sense, a mechanic's lien can be leapfrogged over by equitable subrogation. That'd be one example, Your Honor.
So the question here is which version of the doctrine we should apply and whether it factually applies in your case.
That's right. If I'm not here arguing equitable collateral real estate mortgage, I've got a different argument I have to make to you. The case law that I have found, and frankly, Wells Fargo hasn't found any other case law, universally says in this situation you have to obtain a release of that mortgage, otherwise you're stuck with that home equity loan, collateral real estate loan, whatever you might call it. In a mechanic's lien situation, the last lender may be stuck with that mechanic's lien being ahead of them. They may not, depending on what the facts of the case are.
Well, we're getting off in another area, but mechanic's liens and a closing in the routine, someone has to do an affidavit that there isn't a mechanic lien or there isn't work within 120 days and all of that. If they don't ask for that, how can they not be negligent?
That's true. Because during that 120 days, you can't go to the Register of Deeds office and figure this out for yourself. You got to ask somebody.
But in this case, it was a filed lien.
They recognized it was a filed lien. They paid it down to zero because they knew it was there. If they really wanted it released, and maybe it's just a matter of negligence. I don't know, Judge. If they wanted it released, they should have asked us to release it. I mean, we do this all the time. But if you don't ask us to release it, we're not going to release it. When you buy $50 worth of gas from your credit card to drive home today, and you pay that $50 off at the end of the month, do they take your credit card away from you and say, okay, it's at zero now? No, you get to use your credit card again and again and again, even though the balance goes up and goes down. At some point, I'm sure it wouldn't apply to you, but they might take your credit card away from you. And in this case, if they wanted to take this credit away from my client's borrower, they could have done it. but they didn't. So we shouldn't have to suffer as a result of that. I don't know how much time I have left, but I just want to touch real briefly on two other issues here. In the rebuttal brief, there was a question of whether or not we're arguing the same issue, and I just want to say I don't really understand why that would be brought up. The issue is lien priorities and how you decide lien priorities, and so I don't think the issue on appeal has changed from the issue before the trial court. The other issue is timeliness of appeal. There's two foreclosure judgments in this case. As you might imagine, these young homeowners were under a lot of stress until they found a bankruptcy. And then if you don't have a bankruptcy and everything gets paid off, we don't make these arguments because there's no need to. But in this case, they filed a bankruptcy and left people holding the bag, so to speak. When they filed their bankruptcy roughly in May of, the 1st of May of last year, and a few days later, Wells Fargo then asked the trial judge to sign the mortgage foreclosure that Wells Fargo's counsel had prepared, which I felt properly reflected the judge's decision. I told the judge, I don't agree with you, but that is your decision. And but I didn't know the bankruptcy had been filed. I didn't check. But in fact, the bankruptcy was filed, and to ask the judge to sign a mortgage foreclosure is a violation of federal law. The automatic stay was in effect at that time, and that request shouldn't have been made. But nonetheless, the judgment was entered. We all found out the bankruptcy was filed. So I went to bankruptcy court and asked the judge, may I have relief from stay? May I continue with this mortgage foreclosure action? And I asked the trustee, will you abandon any potential equity you have in the property? Well, of course, there was no equity in the property, so the trustee abandoned the interest in the property. The bankruptcy judge said, sure, go on with your mortgage foreclosure. And then I wrote the trial judge a letter, which I sent to Wells Fargo counsel, and laid out my reason for doing this. I basically said, judge, your judgment is, there's a word for it here that I'm not very familiar with, void from the start, ab initio, I guess is the word. Your judgment wasn't good the day it was signed. And so what I did is I sent the judge the documents from federal court that said, now you can sign a judgment. I sent the very same judgment, very same wording as Wells Fargo had presented to the trial judge, and I said, please enter this judgment. So now we don't have a void judgment, we have a valid judgment. The judge entered that judgment, and within the time period allowed, I began my foreclosure. So I don't think there really were two valid judgments. I know there weren't two valid judgments in this case. There was just the one entered after the bankruptcy stay was lifted. And furthermore, I sent a letter to Wells Fargo, and I said, if you got an objection to this, you know, let's hear what it is. They didn't respond in the time that the judge allowed them to respond, and so that second judgment was entered, and then this appeal came from that. Basically, I have some more questions, Your Honors. That's all I have.
Okay. No one's ever chastised for quitting.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ruffles. Mr. Piper, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Can you please the court, counsel? Wells Fargo has two things I would like to make clear today. The first, that based on the evidence in front of the circuit court below, that summary judgment in favor of Wells Fargo for equitable subrogation was appropriate. The second thing is that the credit union cannot now raise the applicability of equitable subrogation for the first time on appeal. Going to the first question, the circuit court did not err in applying equitable subrogation. Summary judgment is appropriate when there are no facts in dispute. That is well settled in South Dakota and every other jurisdiction. In this case, there were no facts in dispute. The credit union did submit a reply brief to Wells Fargo's motion for summary judgment and stated that facts 19 and 20, which were that the credit union was in second position at the time it obtained its lien on the second property, that was not in dispute. They knew at the time there was they had title work showing that they were in second lien, and that cannot be in dispute. The second fact that...
Wait a minute. When you file a lien, you don't file for first lien, second lien. It's filed by date. It's priority liens. I learned that first year in property law, maybe the first day. How are we getting away from that?
When there's a situation such as this, when there's a less than perfect closing for a loan, the restatement in other jurisdictions, the restatement third, allow for equitable subrogation to apply to avoid a potential inequitable windfall. That's the case here. First Franklin Bank was the original first mortgagee in this case. They had a lien on the property for approximately $120,000.
Why didn't Wells Fargo ask for either a release or a waiver of position or buy the first loan? That's three remedies they had. Why didn't they do that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. Like I said, it was an imperfect closing. The restatement in other jurisdictions allow for equitable subrogation to apply to avoid inequitable windfall.
You're asking equitable principles, but we have a statutory procedure. So are you asking for us to overturn our statute by equity?
I'm asking the court to supplement the statute to allow for fairness in these situations where another mortgagee or lender comes in, pays off the first position and the second position. In this case, it was a line of credit down to zero with the expectation that it would obtain that priority.
But you know, on that point, if you look at the closing documents, Wells Fargo's own documents show that it was fully aware of the CRIM that was in place. In fact, the amount of payoff is shown in the disbursement statement. And so when they closed the loan, if they didn't satisfy the prior loan, how can there be an injustice or an inequity befalling Wells Fargo? Wells Fargo simply failed to get a satisfaction. In your counterclaim, you specifically allege this occurred because of error and inadvertence. So I don't see the injustice befalling Wells Fargo in a case like this. I mean, they're a sophisticated financial institution. And they know they've got a lien out of them. They advance the funds to pay it off. And they, because of error and inadvertence, they don't get a satisfaction.
I apologize. The counterclaim was less clear than it should have been. Wells Fargo was claiming that the inadvertence was that of the credit union, that they erroneously did not satisfy the line of credit.
Was there a demand on them to satisfy their line of credit?
There, unfortunately, the Wells Fargo financial branch closed down. We're not able to obtain, every document we needed. Unfortunately, there isn't evidence in the file.
Closing where if there's a lien prior to yours, that there isn't a satisfaction or subrogation of that lien at the closing and signed and filed? I've never seen that.
There's a case from it's an Ohio court level. It's the same level of court that the credit union cites, and they say Wells Fargo Dupler is saying that there's no reason to allow equitable subrogation in this case. This 2009 case from the same jurisdiction, it is TCIF REO GCM LLC versus National City Bank, 2009 Ohio 4040. In that case, the court did find that there was a first lien that was a regular mortgage, a second lien that was a collateral real estate mortgage. It was actually an open-ended mortgage, but it's the same principle. And another lien holder came in and paid off those first two. And that court determined that the subrogee, the party coming in, obtained a first lien position. Now, I did not find this case until preparing for oral argument. Otherwise, I would have included in my brief.
Then, under our rules, you submit 14 copies to the clerk and give a copy to counsel. Okay.
That was my mistake. I apologize.
Well, no, the case law comes up all the time. But that's just how we deal with it, so that everybody has an opportunity to read it.
When we go back, you can submit that.
Yeah, you don't have to do it today. Just when you get back to the office, send us the copies. Or back.
Copies of the case, or is it? And and whatnot.
Just copies of the case.
Yes, Your Honor. So in this Ohio case that I just cited, the TCIF case, it basically distinguishes the previous case law from the Wells Fargo Dupler case that, and it allows, a subrogee to come in and take that first in position. Every ethical subrogation case that has been cited, the court lays out that every case is different. You need to consider all the facts involved. Here, Wells Fargo paid off the first one about approximately $120,000, the line of credit that was approximately $24,000, and some junior liens that were below the credit union. And the loan was refinanced for approximately $168,000. Wells Fargo is not claiming that it's entitled to everything above the full amount. It is claiming it is in a first lien position to what it paid for those first two liens. Wells Fargo is not expected to put the credit union behind them for the amount that it paid for a third and fourth and fifth junior liens that were behind them to begin with.
I guess my concern here is, former life, they used to read abstracts when they were still the way you looked at land titles, and now I suppose it's all title insurance. And we always went by priority. And you would then certify the priority to the lender so the lender could have confidence that they were in a position where their loan was secure. How is the person, whether it be a lawyer reading an abstract or title insurance, going to secure or certify a priority if you now could have a leapfrog by equitable subrogation rather than just looking at the dates of filing? Isn't it going to rain chaos on our method of lending on real estate in the state?
I don't believe it'll bring chaos. In the vast majority, from my experience, most refinances are very pristine and handled perfectly. Unfortunately, this was not the case. This was handled in a less than perfect manner, both by Wells Fargo and by the credit union. The credit union allows a line of credit borrower to come in and just obtain whatever's not open on line of credit, going to the cashier.
Why not? They have their prior. They made their determination, even though it was paid down. How do they even know that there was another lender made? You're getting away from the statutes, which are very clear. First in time, file your lien. And it's notice to the world. Anybody can go look.
At the time that the credit union obtained their lien, they were in second position the whole time.
Well, you don't file a second position when you file. You file by date.
Correct. And my point is that they knew that they were going to be behind another lien. In this case, Wells Fargo paid off the first lien with the expectation, pursuant to the restatement, that they would obtain that lien, and the credit union obtained $24,000.
The restatement?
I'm sorry?
Are there any facts that they relied on their restatement in making their decision?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking the court to follow the restatement, since it seems to be the most fair way to handle this type of situation. Moving to the issue of whether the credit union can appeal this or not. South Dakota Codified Law 1526A-10 allows the Supreme Court to review all matters appearing on a record relevant to the question of whether the order appealed from is erroneous. Now, the question below was whether equitable subrogation allowed Wells Fargo to obtain a first position. The issue is narrowed, and the credit union suggests that the issue is strictly priority. The question is whether Wells Fargo obtained a position based on the doctrine. If the court allows the credit union to come in the second time at the appellate level and say, lien priority, that's it. It opens a very broad spectrum for future parties that don't obtain a favorable outcome at the lower level to appeal. Now, in Nelson v. City of Sioux Falls, which I cite in my brief, there was water damage to Nelson's property. caused by, well, the court found it was caused by the city of Sioux Falls. The city of Sioux Falls below at the appellate or at the circuit court level claimed that it was not liable because it didn't cause the overflow. The overarching issue there is liability. The question presented below was whether it was liable because it didn't cause the overflow. They lost on appeal. They weren't liable because the owner of the property didn't own the property until after the improvements were made. The court found that that was never raised at the lower level, that they were not the property owner below it, and they couldn't raise it at the appellate level.
But you know, in this case, you were the one, or Wells Fargo was the one that raised the doctrine of equitable subrogation below, and the credit union was merely defending that claim. So they had no burden to raise equitable subrogation below. You raised it, and they responded to it. That puts it squarely before us, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor. They raised the issue in their appellate brief or in their reply to our Wells Fargo's motion for summary judgment that their line of credit was never satisfied. That's different versus whether my client jumps up and takes the first and the second position, and it also is different from whether my client leapfrogs up and takes just the first position ahead of line of credit. So I believe that
you're
very distinguishable.
You claimed you got to first position by using the doctrine of equitable subrogation.
Correct.
And they responded defensively to that claim, and now it's before us.
They responded that it was never satisfied.
Right.
That's a different issue than whether equitable subrogation was applicable. At the lower level, Wells Fargo briefed and set out all four elements of equitable subrogation, which are whether a subrogee was obligated on the original debt, whether that was paid in full, whether the subrogee is a volunteer, and then whether injustice will be done to the intervening lien holders. None of those four elements were argued below, and they can't be argued now. That's Wells Fargo's position. Unless there are any other questions, that's all I have.
Are you abandoning any claim on the timing of the appeal?
No, Your Honor, I'm not abandoning it.
Well, then how do you address the automatic stay in bankruptcy court?
I guess we're going to abandon it, Your Honor.
Just to make it clear, it's easier for us if we know where you're at. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Piper. I told Mr. Ruffolds no one's ever chastised us for quitting early. Mr. Ruffolds, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I have just one item, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. You asked whether or not there was a request to satisfy. It's right in my brief. They did request that the home equity loan be satisfied. They requested on May 9th, 2005. The closing statement is, this goes to your question a minute ago, the closing statement is March 11, 2005. So they waited 2 months to ask for a satisfaction. We gave them, and I don't know that we gave them a satisfaction at that time, frankly, but we quit lending. We didn't lend any more money out at that time. We didn't make the situation worse. If they had given us this on the day of the closing, I wouldn't make this argument to you.
I was a little confused by the briefs. Did they ask for a satisfaction, or did they ask that there not be any more money?
Well, the word is very clear. It says, please close my second mortgage line of credit. To us, that means we're not going to lend any more money out. They didn't ask that we satisfy the underlying mortgage securing that note. Why didn't they ask? South Dakota law doesn't allow you to ask at that time. South Dakota law says unless the note is zero, you can't ask and receive a satisfaction. So they told us to quit lending 2 months after the horse is out of the barn. But they never ask us for a satisfaction because clearly you can't ask us for a satisfaction at that point. When you know the horse is out of the barn, we get to keep the security in the real estate.
Well, they could have asked for the satisfaction if the borrower had come with the check in hand from Wells Fargo, a joint payable check to the credit union and the borrower saying, release, give me a satisfaction of this crime.
And we'd have given it to him immediately.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have this problem today if we'd have done that.